Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Michael Dresser Show. There's no topic this program is afraid to address or investigate, whether it be social, political, or current events, including some very sensitive cultural issues of today. The views expressed by the host, guest, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views of this station. Now, step into the realm of clarity with your host, Michael Dresser.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Leslie Beth Wish with us is a nationally recognized psychologist. She serves as the Medical Advisory Board for Quality Health and is the founder of LoveVictory.com, the co-founder of the Family Counseling Network for the Special Operations Warrior Foundation. Her column, Ask Dr. Wish, appears on yarsway.com. She writes at showcasingwomen.com, and she's the author of Smart Relationships. And let's say, Leslie Beth, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad we're doing this.
Oh, and thank you for being here. Smart Relationships, How Successful Women Can Find True Love. Do we have to know what true love is before we can actually find it? Because this is not something that you can really find in school. They don't teach you what it is. We model what our parents get, and if they don't have it, then we end up not having it. So I really guess the question is, if we don't know what we're looking for, how do we find it?
Well, that's a good point. You know, you go through high school. You can graduate high school in almost every high school in the United States without having to take a self-psychology course. So we end up being somewhat stupid about ourselves and our needs and what makes people tick. So it's very hard to learn that stuff. And even if you do go through life with trial and error, it doesn't mean you've learned from it. So it automatically puts a person at a tremendous disadvantage.
And I think what happens with most of us, we fall in love with the form, whatever that is, and really not the person. There are people who want to be married, and all they want to do is be married. And if somebody comes along and they happen to fit that particular category at the moment, then you get married. And I think there's where the problem is also. We haven't learned to really touch and see each other.
And we haven't learned to do psychological self-examination. That is very scary, to really reckon with yourself. But, you know, if you don't do that, you're automatically on a downhill slope towards having an increased potential in making a love mistake.
One of the things that I've seen over and over for years, I've asked a question time and again, and I've said to someone, let's say it's a woman, and I've said to her, define your father emotionally, not physically, but emotionally. And then they would define, and then say, okay, define your mother emotionally. And 9 out of 10 times, or maybe 11 out of 10 times, the person that they've been with is either going to fall into one of those definitions, and we find ourselves, let's say, with a woman marrying or being involved in a relationship with the same guy with a different body each time because they haven't caught what it was that they haven't completed with that mom or dad out there.
You said a very important word, Michael. You said the word haven't completed, the words haven't completed. Usually what happens, not always, but usually what happens is a person seeks someone who resembles the parent with whom they have the most incomplete relationship. So it's sort of an attachment hunger of wanting to try again, to get it right, to feel loved. And sometimes it works, but a lot of the times it really doesn't.
I remember years ago, someone said to me, you know, your dad rejected you. I said, what do you mean he rejected me? He died when I was 8 years old. And it was very interesting because he said, the opposite of acceptance is rejection. So we automatically and consciously take it on as a rejection. And I remember when I was young, there was probably 3 or 4 women in my life that I drove out of my life just to prove that someone would leave me. And those unconscious thoughts that drive your life.
And we have so many of them. And that was one of the things that really surprised me when I started doing my research for my book, Smart Relationships. I tend to write and research about things that bother me, and it had bothered me for a very long time that I saw an increasing number of women in my client population, family, friends, colleagues, who were very, very accomplished. They were career-minded. They had training, education, advanced degrees, all kinds of responsibility at work, but they were absolutely clueless about love, and I wanted to know why. And one of the top mistakes that women make, not the number one, but we can talk about that in a moment, but one of the top ones they made was going back and forth between choosing someone like the incompleted parental, you know, relationship,
sure,
or overcorrecting and then choosing someone so opposite that that created another problem.
Now, by the way, when we take a look at the, you know, the choices we make, we see somebody, and it's like walking into a room, and there's somebody that, for some reason, you just don't like that person, or the reverse of it, you like that person. It's nothing more than a projection. It's something that you like or dislike about yourself, or it was familiar, maybe somebody in the past either looked like that or felt like that, etc. I really wonder how much reality that we really walk through in our life, and instead of living forward, we're living backward.
Okay, I can talk to a couple of those points in there, because you're saying in different words exactly what came out of my research. Number one, the cultural message right now, and it's been there for a long, long time, is that when you see someone, there has to be chemistry, that instant kick in the head, that click in the heart. And sometimes chemistry can lead you to choose a poor choice just as often, if not more, than a wise choice, because chemistry is often a mix of hormones, hope, and history, your family history. Secondly, what you also hit on was the sense of not knowing what to trust, not knowing whether to believe that, and falling for those beliefs that what I feel is right, and you don't know that you've projected those feelings onto someone else because they have a certain way of acting, or you pick up nonverbal cues. And so it's very important, so important, and this is what the women in my study couldn't do very well, was to take their time in dating. Postpone sex, not because of any ethical or religious reasons, although those are often reasons enough, but because once sex starts, you activate your need to attach and to justify in your mind that this is a good decision. And so already you're just going down the wrong road.
Now, have we added too much to sex? And when I say added too much to it, you know, there's so many things. You know, the world seems to be revolved around either sex or violence today, and I really don't like saying what I just said. That was the butler on the computer, so don't pay attention to him.
Sure.
He says, "You have mail, sir." First time I got it, 3 o'clock in the morning, I got mail and somebody was talking to me. But we've learned so much about what sex, you know, actually means. I don't think there's any courses where people are taught what sex really is. It goes way beyond the physical act. I mean, obviously, we know that. But there's so many people that get into problems because they don't know it. And what they're looking for isn't really what they find.
And so many of the women, again, in my study, the number two dating pattern mistake that they made was falling for a man of excitement, and that includes sexual excitement. So
sure.
Many of the women in my study were all work and no play, or they had gotten into the swearing off men mindset after they'd been so hurt. So both of those positions, swearing off men and saying, you know, I'm done, I'm not going down there, who needs a guy, or falling for a man of excitement and becoming all work and no play, which leaves you vulnerable to that, you end up with having sex too soon, a man who sweeps you away, and suddenly you get lost, very, very lost emotionally, and even in terms of your own identity, knowing who you are and what you need and want. And these relationships tend to get out of control, and they often start with sex too soon, and it's often exciting sex, out-of-control sex, someone just sweeping you away, and then those hormones kick in and the brain chemicals kick in that make you want to stay with that person.
Well, let's talk identity for a moment. The most important thing that a person can capture about themselves is their identity, and I would venture to guess if we walked down the street and asked people, 100 people, what their identity was, most of them couldn't even tell you because they're still out there searching for it. And going, you know, to the guy that's extra hot and so on and so forth, you're creating an identity through it. Sex can become an identity. And I think that in and of itself can be very confusing for a lot of people. Your identity doesn't come externally, it comes internally, and I think that's where the problem is.
And it sounds so easy, doesn't it? But my heart goes out to the people who were in my study and to other women who are my clients, it sounds so simple. Get brave. Face your shortcomings. If you can't, get professional help. Don't do more of the same if it's not yielding good results. Make sure that you respect the you who is you in the relationship, and make sure you respect your partner. Sounds so simple, and yet it's so very hard to enact.
And I think one of the biggest problems there is our need for love. It just gives tremendous power to the opinions of other people. So it's so easy to turn your life over to the expectations of someone else. And I think that's where the problem is. We are trying to be the or let me say it this way. At my optimum best, at my optimum, I could only be the second best you. No matter how hard I tried, I can never be the best you at being you. So I'm never going to be perfect. I can only be the perfect me. And I think there's where the problem is. The identity is sought through someone else, someone external. And you don't get your own, because I want to be liked. I want to avoid conflict. I want to be understood. And then we become shaped by what somebody else thinks about us, and that's where our life is, and that's where the problems start.
Well, the women in my study didn't express that as much as making the mistake, although they couldn't give words to it. You know, there are two main things, if we put it in everyday terms, that we all need with an intimate partner, and that's to feel safe and warm. But it's how you interpret those words and how you connect or recognize or interpret your feelings that make that go awry. So feeling safe with someone means you trust them. You trust their ability to be your wingman or wingwoman. And feeling warm means that they understand you as much as they can, that they aim to understand you, that they're empathic. But what happened to the women in my study, and this was true across the board regardless of income or education level, they often would choose one and not the other. So they would end up choosing someone who was supportive and sweet and kind, but they ended up being someone who couldn't tie his shoes when he walked out the door or come out of the rain. And that did not make them feel safe. They didn't feel that they had a partner to go over the ups and downs and all the kinds of trials and errors that life represents. So what they would do is overcorrect and choose someone who offered them safety but not warmth. So they often would choose lion men, men of authority, competence, efficiency, often fame, recognition, and there's nothing wrong with those kinds of qualities in a man. But so many of the women mistook their authoritarianism as an air of authority. And so they ended up in abusive relationships. So what did they do again? One of two things. Flipped back to someone who was only warm but couldn't tie their shoes, or then they swore off men. So it wasn't so much as having an identity or borrowing an identity. It was protecting themselves from any future hurt.
Well, okay, fear of rejection. And when you would come down to it, wanting to be liked and the rest of it and so on and so forth, it's that want and that fear of rejection that causes these things. It's very interesting, and I would venture to guess that most relationships, if I was a woman, I probably couldn't tell you who that man was that I was with, you know, because I'll see them through my eyes.
And rejection speaks to the number one fundamental fear that all human beings and most primates have, probably all primates, and that's being abandoned. So on the deepest level, what happens in unhealthy relationships is that we over-adapt and we over-tolerate things that we shouldn't for the sake of being attached.
Yeah, and it's called survival when you really come down to it.
It is. Absolutely.
When you did the research, was there one something that made you, when you saw it, when you recognized it, made you sit back and go into shock?
Yeah, there were a couple things that absolutely surprised me. You know, I had in the core study over 1,200 women, but that I didn't count in that core study the 10,000s of women I've seen, you know, as my clients, because I didn't use a clinical population. So when you put all those people together, the two things that really jumped out at me that totally threw me, and I'm sure most researchers don't want to admit that they didn't see something coming, but I didn't see it, and that's the increased incidence of suicide attempts. That really surprised me, over love gone wrong. And I'm talking about women who are financially independent, have their career mindedness in set, they've had good training, education, they're on their way to feeling, you know, increasingly satisfied and in charge of their work. But that wasn't enough. And so when things went wrong, they attempted suicide. That was the first thing that absolutely surprised me. And the other thing...
Go ahead.
Oh,
I was going to say that I'm going to jump ahead with this just for a moment because we're starting to run out of time, but there's a question I've asked over the years, and it doesn't matter whether it's subject matter, it's fact, fun, fantasy, whatever the case may be. There comes that point in writing the book, no matter what kind of research you've done or fact gathering, et cetera, there comes that time when you get that cathartic aha moment when you recognize something about yourself that you weren't aware of. Where did that happen for you here?
It certainly didn't happen with suicide. It happened for me with one of the other findings. I wouldn't say it was a big aha. I kind of knew it, but it just confirmed it. Let's put it that way. A lot of the women came from divorced families. I don't, but a lot of the women came from divorced families and single mothers. And what happened when these women grew up and went to college or training, they said, I am never going to be in the same position my mother is in. I am not going to be struggling economically, and I'm not going to have a parade of guys going through my apartment. But what happened was, and this goes back to the point that you made about abandonment, the deep-seated need to be connected to one's caregivers, parents usually, is never lost. It's very hard to give that up. And so what these women did was they struck a bargain with the devil, very unconsciously, that goes something like this. I will pursue a career and leave my mother in the dust, but then the way I will assuage my surpassers' guilt is to have the same kinds of problems my mother did in love. Now, I was very aware of that concept when I was growing up, but it just really sealed the deal that this was something really important to help other women learn about. And that's what they did. They repeated so many of their mother's mistakes.
Unconscious loyalty, when you really come down to it.
That's exactly. And loyalty, yes, and loyalty for the sake of, as what you said, for survival. Even though it may not be real survival, it's that archaic limbic system sense of primary survival.
Absolutely, that emotional part of your brain that runs your entire life, even if you don't want it to. Now, we're about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at, and where
yes.
can you get the book?
Yes, please go to my website, lovevictory.com. Please sign up there to receive my blogs and other information. And my books, Smart Relationships and the companion cartoon book, which is a visual story based on the research, is called The Love Adventures of Almost Smart Cookie. Both books are on my website. And they can follow me on Facebook at LB Wish Love Victory.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Your questions were terrific.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down the street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down the street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Ah.
Meaning a mouthful of things to say.
so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Wendy Dauber with us is an Option Method master teacher, a coach, a yoga teacher, author, and the founder of Dialogues in Self-Discovery Center for the Option Method. She's the author of The Guru Next Door, A Teacher's Legacy. Wendy, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Michael.
Now, when we talk about a teacher's legacy, we have so many people who are teachers. They are, they get their degrees and they teach. And then there are people who are teachers in the everyday world of life. And I really believe in my heart of hearts that when you open your eyes in the morning, everybody you run into in one way, shape, or form is a teacher.
Oh, I agree with that wholeheartedly.
Yeah, we learn. It's interesting. And, we fall down. Sometimes we stay there. Sometimes we get up. But every life experience happens to be a lesson, and if you can move your way through, then it really begins to work. And I think one of the things, and we'll go right to issue here, is who teaches you how to be happy? And I think there, in and of itself, is probably the biggest question that we can face in our life.
Oh, I agree with that. And I think that the people that happiness, in a sense, is not something that needs to be taught. But in a sense, it's something that we can learn about by looking at other people and seeing if they're happy and how their happiness, what their happiness looks like. And I think often from that, we learn to look into ourselves and see how we can be happy. So happiness. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh no, I'm an old radio guy. If I heard a bit of silence, I'm in there. But I think when it comes down to it, is happy. I have learned what happiness is. If you can be angry at someone, it doesn't mean that deep down you're not happy. Happiness isn't something that it doesn't come in spurts. It's always there, and sometimes it's buried under the what you're going through at the time. But happiness is something that allows you to look in the mirror and smile at yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a fantastic way of putting it. And I would just make a distinction there and say that as long as you're happy with yourself, if you're angry. Because what happens a lot with people that are angry is that they're not happy with themselves. They look at themselves and they say, I shouldn't be angry. And then they get unhappy about that. So if you're happy with the way that you're feeling, you're happy. But if you're not, that's another question altogether.
But isn't this all built on belief?
Absolutely. It's absolutely built on belief. And, if you think of it this way, a very simple way of thinking about it is that if we believe that something is good for us, if we believe that something is good for our happiness specifically, we're going to be happy. And if we believe that something is bad for our happiness, we're going to feel bad. We're going to be unhappy. And if you can kind of very simplistically divide things up like that, that has a lot to do with why people get unhappy and why people are not unhappy. It's not because of what happens to them. It's because of what they believe.
Oh, absolutely.
How they believe it will affect them.
Sure. And I think belief in and of itself, very interesting. When we talk about changing a belief, The first thought with somebody is, you got to change your entire way of life and your beliefs and everything's got to be different now. That's not so. A change in belief is as simple as you didn't think you could do it, now you can do it. From I can't to I can. That's an entire change in belief and an entire change in your life.
Yes. And, I know that I agree with you that sometimes people think that it's very hard to change a belief. But if you look back in your life, and you look at all the beliefs that you have changed. For example, how many of us used to believe in Santa Claus? And I hope I'm not letting the cat out of the bag, but...
Oh, no, don't go any farther. I don't think I can take it.
But we change our beliefs as we as knowledge comes into play. And, you know, a lot of times when I work with people and they see the belief, I thought that I had to be unhappy about this because if I wasn't unhappy, it would mean I didn't care. That's a big one. And sometimes people will look at that and they'll say, I'm so happy to know that. And, of course, I don't believe that. Other people will look at that and say, oh, my God, why did I believe that all these years? And then they go into feeling bad about that. So there are beliefs about beliefs as well, and we can look at all of it.
Yeah, well, in a change in belief, I still believe in Santa Claus. I really do, but not the jolly Saint Nick with the beard and the rest of it. Santa Claus is a mindset. Santa Claus is walking down the street and listening to the Christmas music, and people going in and out of the stores and shopping, and the kids, you know, in the morning and opening presents and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, but see, I shifted a belief. I shifted the belief from the Santa Claus to the symbolic Santa Claus of what it truly, really is. And it's a cultural mindset. And but that was a shift in my belief system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a really beautiful way of looking at it. And I love this time of year. I just love this time of year. And one of the things I really love about it is just the essence of giving and sharing and love and happiness is really out there in a big way, and I just love seeing that.
You know, by the way, I was brought up in the 50s, so I'm one of those man up, get it done. You know, if you get hit and bleed, you know, you suck it up and you move forward. Okay, that's
right.
I got so tired of all this killing and everything going on in the movies that you see constantly. It's enough already. And for the last 2-3 weeks, I've been on, what was it, the Hallmark Channel and the Lifetime Channel, and it's been the Santa Claus and Christmas movies across the board, and they're actually wonderful. It gives you that something inside that allows you to be happy. You don't have to worry about walking down the hall and somebody jumping out of a dark closet and biting you.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, getting back to beliefs again, when people believe that things can make them unhappy, that's how they live their lives. They live their lives in the back of their mind always thinking that something's going to jump out at them. You know, and even when they're happy, they have that feeling that, oh, this is going to be taken away from me. So if you can really look at your beliefs and free yourself of those beliefs, when you're happy, you can be happy with a capital H instead of a small H.
Oh, sure. And I really believe when it comes down to it, believe, and that's really what we're all about. It's a believe you can, or, again, a believe that you can't do it, or you can feel good or you can feel bad. You have the choice, and I think that's where, you know, when you do what you do with the option method, options, I think the big problem that most people run into is they don't realize there are choice and options to move through the feelings that they experience.
Right. Yes. And if they don't think that they – and I think one of the reasons why they think there aren't options is because they can't imagine how they would work. You know, I think if somebody – tells you that something is possible and shows you how it's possible, you might think about it differently and know that you could use that information that they're giving you. But if you just think that it's just not possible and you can't imagine how it could be possible, you're not seeing your way clear to a choice. And that's what the option method helps people to do. It shows them how they can get in touch with their choice.
And by the way, with an option, with a choice, which we all have, it's not that we don't know. We don't know that we don't know. I think there's where the problem is. But,
yes.
Moving through. Where did that come from? Where did that belief start? You know, and if you can find out where it started, then you can take a look at it and move through with whatever that you – I can't get the words out of my mouth. Whatever, it's Monday, so I get a pass on that one. With whatever – it's Tuesday. I know where we are. With whatever it is that you want to do, as long as you realize that there are other options and behaviors that you can take to accomplish a goal.
Right. And it's all about seeing how these beliefs have served you, because you wouldn't be holding on to them if you didn't think that they served you. And, yes, they are hidden in a sense, except that sometimes we can actually hear our beliefs, because we can hear ourselves saying, oh, you know, I'm not going to do that because I'm afraid that, you know, if I took that risk, I'm going to end up even worse off than I was before. So we enunciate our beliefs to ourselves all the time, but not always. Sometimes when we say, I'm terrified of losing my job, we don't necessarily know that there what the belief is that's behind that. And there is a belief behind it, and it's something that we're believing because it makes sense to us until we bring it out into the light and look at it.
Now, by the way, where was the option option method created?
The option method was created by Bruce DeMarsico in the late 60s, right here in Montclair, New Jersey, where I'm sitting right now. So that's Bruce was living here at the time, and he created it at that time. And he was looking for a way to help people to stop being unhappy. And he was asking himself the question, why are people so unhappy? Why are they so unhappy? He really wanted to know the answer. And he came up with an approach that assumed that, well, it's actually not an assumption, it's a knowing, if you will, that happiness is our natural state, but when we believe that we can't be happy, we do the next best thing. And the next best thing is often choosing unhappiness.
Yeah, and by the way, I think that's really important to look at, choosing unhappiness, not intentionally choosing unhappiness,
right?
But I'm going to lose it, so I have to feel this way. I'm going to be sad because of this, and we choose the way we're going to be because that's what's supposed to be the right way to go for us.
Oh, yes. I mean, that's so true. That's so true. I mean, when you think about it, so much of the world seems to turn on an agreement about when we're supposed to be unhappy. And if you're not unhappy, people might consider you to be crazy. They might think that there's something wrong with you if you're not unhappy at the right time, the appropriate time.
No, but when it really comes down to it, everything that we're talking about right now happens to be so simple. The problem is we as a human race, we don't want to see it. And because we don't want to see it, we create these complexities that allow us to not see it so we don't have to face the world that we live in.
Right. Yeah, and so in a way, go ahead.
So I was going to say, I happened to glance at something here. His wife, Deborah, she's a psychologist in Los Angeles, right?
His wife, she lives in Locke, California. You're talking about Bruce's widow, Deborah?
Yeah.
Yeah. She's not a psychologist. She's an option method teacher also, and she's based in California.
Yeah, okay. You know, I happened to see that, and I looked at it with the wrong spelling because there is a Deborah Mandel, who is a psychologist.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they happen. But when you really come down to it, you know, and you go back to the 60s and we look at what we have now, the culture is different. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
But the problems are the same.
Right.
It doesn't change.
Mm-hmm. No, and it's amazing how it's amazing how it doesn't change in a way, but so much has changed. You know, like you say, back in the 60s when Bruce was first talking about the option method, nobody was talking about beliefs being connected to emotions. And, you know, nobody was really talking about happiness and unhappiness. And today, I mean, if you Google happiness, you get millions and millions of responses about it. And people are connecting beliefs to emotion these days. So things have, our consciousness is shifting. But the shift is not complete. We're not there yet.
No, and I hear you loud and clear. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at?
Yes, thank you. The website is dialogueandselfdiscovery.com.
Wonderful. Dialogueandselfdiscovery.com. And we can get the book there?
Yes, so the book is available. There's a store on the website, and it has books, CDs, the Guru Next Door, as well as other books that we have available.
Wonderful. Hey, Wendy, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It was really a lot of fun.
Great. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So lonely, you're going to miss my hugging, you miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in Rome, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy, 'cause I wanna leave you. Yeah. It's some of these days I do it so good, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
back on Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Gail Martin with us, founded Dream Spinner Communications in 2003. Now she works with companies all over the U.S. and Canada. She is the author of 30 Days to Online PR and Marketing Success, the 30-Day Results Guide to Making the Most of Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Blogging to Grab Headlines and Get Clients, and 30 Days to Social Media Success. Gail blogs at bigdreamsandhardwork.com, and she's the host of the Share Dreams Marketing Podcast. She's an international speaker on marketing and social media, and in her spare time, oh, that's a good word, she writes a best-selling fantasy adventure series of books. Hi, Gail. Welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here. Nice to talk to you, Michael.
Spare time, huh?
Spare time, yeah. Well, everybody needs a hobby.
Yeah, well, that sounded good. Okay. Now, by the way, social media today, I truly believe, you know, you look at people in business today. We started out way back, years and years ago, we had, you know, the mom and pops, and they had those great little businesses, and you walked in, they knew you, they knew your dog, they knew everybody. And then corporations came in, mom and pop couldn't compete, they went out of business. And then the corporations went multinational, and they went up against the businesses that they couldn't compete against. So they outsourced everybody, and what did everybody do? They went home and started their own businesses. Now it's a completely different world. You might have a great business, but if you don't know how to deal with social media and how to work with that e-consumer out there, you're in big trouble, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, what I think is really funny, you know, you talk about the mom-and-pop stores. The Internet has really brought us back to a small community. And I think one of the biggest mistakes that business owners make is acting like they're in a big city on the Internet when the Internet is really Mayberry.
Sure.
You know, the Internet, you talk about people knowing you and your dog and everything else, they do on the Internet, too.
Yeah.
And you want them to a point, because people want to do business with people they know. We're tired of faceless corporations.
No, absolutely. Walk into a market today and you don't see somebody with their name on a tag. It's associate number 365-3. And we've gotten away from it, and everybody is not touching everybody anymore.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think we hunger for that. And that's why you see the response that people have made to sites like Yelp and rating sites where, you know, you used to lean over your fence in your backyard and say, hey, I went to that new restaurant. The food was only so-so, or the food was fantastic.
Now you go on Yelp, you go on Urban Spoon, you go on one of the other rating sites, and you say the same thing. But, boy, is that helpful when you find yourself in a new city and you're going, where do I eat? Where's good?
Sure.
You rely on the same neighborhood grapevine. It's just a little bigger neighborhood.
Sure, and what it comes down to basically is this. When you look at it, if you have a product, a service, some kind of offering today, in the old days you might have had, though, 5-6 people, you know, you're competing against for that same offering for that consumer. But today you've got hundreds of thousands of people out there competitive with you. And if you don't know the roadmap and how to do it, you're going to get swallowed up very rapidly.
Well, that's true. But at the same time, all of those hundreds of thousands of people aren't just like you. And that's where the Internet has given us a tremendous customization opportunity. I always tell people to find your tribe. I show my clients how to find their tribe. And their tribe are the people that their particular approach and product and message resonate with. So you're not really competing with all of those hundreds of thousands, because your ideal clients are going to click with you because you are you. They just have to be able to find you to know that.
Well, they've got to hear that certain something that you have that's going to affect them personally, and I think that's really where it is. You know, you listen to a lot of ads, it's not that very personal to you. And when you've got that, when you hear that, like radio, for instance, radio is background. You know, when's the last time that you remember sitting in front of a radio and staring at and listening to the programs? Not for years and years and years and years, and then some.
Well, I don't know. 2 days ago when I was in the car.
Okay, but also, too, you're driving down the street, you're looking for Jackson Street, you're thinking you've got to make a left here, and you're watching this. So, but unless it's that specific something that relates to you, you don't hear it. But if you do have that, you hear it above all the noise.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, it's kind of the same in radio. People find the shows that resonate with them and the hosts that really feel like a friend after a while. When you tune into a show long enough, you get to know that person. You've heard their stories. They'll say things about their, you know, their private life. You get to feel like you know them. That's the same kind of small-town feel that the Internet gives us the opportunity to cultivate as business owners.
Sure, no question about it. And it's that relatable something. And I think if you can't hold hands with the person, symbolically, if you can't hold hands with the person you're going to buy something with, most of the time you don't do it. And it has nothing to do with price or anything else. Because if that product is, if there's that compelling reason to buy, you'll find the way to get the money to buy it.
Oh, and that's completely true. And I think it becomes even more true when you move out of commodity-type purchases and into professional services or one-of-a-kind sort of pieces like artisan pieces or custom-created pieces. You've got to have a personal connection there to feel like this is the person who can guide you, or this is the person whose work really means something to me.
Now, by the way, when it comes down to it, there's a tremendous amount of people starting new businesses today. Most common mistake new business owners make with the online, their PR, their marketing, what is something that you found an overarching theme with?
Well, I think the most common mistake is people who still feel like they don't have to be on social media, and so they're completely absent. And that's really sad, because just like nowadays you feel like a company isn't really in business if they don't have a website, then now I think consumers really feel like a company's not really in business unless you can find them on Facebook, unless they're present on social media. And it's such an easy thing to fix, but I think a lot of businesses either don't believe their customers are out there or just don't think it's worth the effort.
Okay, now, is it not the effort, and this is the question, is it not the effort or they just don't know?
You know, it's a toss-up. I've heard both from companies. Sometimes they don't want to admit that they don't know, or sometimes they don't want to admit that they're scared. But it really is where your customers are looking to find out more about you and make that connection. And if they're not having that conversation with you, you can bet they're having that conversation with one of your competitors.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's true. And I really believe today, more than any other time in our entire history, that if you are not aware of the power, and I say the power, of social media, you get into the LinkedIn, the Facebook, the Twitter, and so on and so forth, and there's so much more out there that we don't even think about, that you're costing yourself money.
Oh, you're costing yourself money, and you're also not doing everything you can to stand out from the competition. You know, I worked with a guy who had a company that refinished stone and granite, and he could do marvelous things with bringing back tired, scarred, stained granite and flooring. But he was really worried because he wasn't getting enough traffic to his website, he wasn't getting enough traffic to his Facebook page, and that's where I came into the picture. And as I was talking to him, I said, okay, Stu, do you have any pictures of all these marvelous renovations you've done? And he said, I've got tons of them. I said, well, why aren't they on your Facebook page? Why aren't they on your website? Why aren't they on Pinterest? You have an amazing before and after visual story. Why aren't those photos out there selling your product for you? Something that simple. He already had the photos. It just hadn't occurred to him to put them out there where people could see them and go, wow, I want what he did to their kitchen.
No, absolutely. And I think that's really what it takes. And there's another consumer out there that most people forget about completely, the somebody who knows somebody who can use whatever is being offered. And a lot of people forget that. You know, you will talk to, sell to that person who's your target market, and the general audience is always going to be out there, and there are people who just aren't going to be interested in your offer, and I don't care what the offering is. And then there's that target market, but there's also that market of someone who knows someone, and most people forget about them completely, and there's a tremendous amount of business out there. I may not be interested in what you have to offer, but I've got five friends who are.
You know, that is a beautiful example of a hidden market. And sometimes it's as simple as saying, if you know somebody who has this interest, has this need, could use this product, please share this with them. I've done that on the fiction side of my life when I do a book signing. I'll mention, you know, if you like fantasy adventure fiction or you know someone who does, this is a great book. And I see the connection go on in their eyes so many times, and they'll say, well, you know, I don't read that, but my sister sure does, my son, my husband, my wife. Or I'll say, you know, a signed book makes a great Christmas present. And again, the light goes on. They hadn't thought of it before that, but, oh, my gosh, I could give them a signed book. You've got to help people know that they want what you have to offer.
Oh, by the way, excuse me, by the way, when you really come down to it, you have to know what you're doing there in the first place and what your focus and what your goal is. There are too many people that go in to sell something. They have no idea why they're there. And if you stay focused and you know why you're there and what you want your audience to do, all of a sudden magic starts to happen.
And social media is where that conversation starts. And I think that is why a lot of people hold back from it, because they're not sure which conversation to have. And it doesn't have to be, and it shouldn't be, a strong sales conversation. It should be a helpful conversation, an interesting conversation. Sometimes it can even be tangential to what you sell. I worked with a company once. They were in the cell phone business. They wanted to create a Facebook page, but they didn't want to talk about business issues because a lot of that was proprietary. But they knew they wanted to stay in touch with their customers between sales so that the connection remained warm and they stayed top of mind. Well, it turned out this company gave business books to their customers every year for the holidays instead of a cookie plate. And that's when the light went on. And I said, Adele, this is what you can talk about on your Facebook page. Make it about the books that are helpful to your business. And now you're not giving away any trade secrets, but you're being helpful. You're creating relationship. People have a reason to stay in contact with you. And it was a perfect fit for their business. So it doesn't have to be hard selling all the time, and it probably shouldn't be.
No, I learned a long time ago, and especially with the market that's out there now, this e-consumer, you can't sell anybody anything. They have to buy it, and that's that transition. And when you can frame it in such a way that they can see what the need is for whatever the offering is, then the world turns around, and that's really what it's about. People, you can't tell anybody anything anymore. They have to make those decisions for themselves.
Well, and just demonstrating your expertise by providing information that's useful gives people a little bit of a chance to try before they buy. And if you're helpful, if you're polite, if you are kind and you supply knowledgeable information, they're either going to decide you're the best fit for them or they're going to refer you to someone else who needs you.
Or you walk up and you say, I've got a product here that if you buy it right now, it's going to get you $10 million a week. It's guaranteed, and I've got everybody who you need to talk to that will do it. All of a sudden, they don't care if they like you, they trust you, or anything. They buy the product. It's that compelling reason to buy.
If you have that kind of an overwhelming, compelling reason, I guess so, but you better make sure you can deliver on that promise.
Oh, no, I was talking about delivering. I said, you know, with the people to prove it and whatever. That's that certain something that they're waiting to hear. And I truly believe when it comes down to it, there is no such thing as I can't afford it. The most important, the key word here is compelling, the compelling reason to buy. If you have it, that you can back up on, with, honestly, without the, trying to cheat.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got that compelling reason, nobody ever says no to you. But you have to have the compelling reason.
Sure. Sure. If you've got what they want, then that's the winning ticket.
Yeah, and especially with what you're saying, because if, let's say I've got what somebody wants, it's a winning ticket, and maybe I know I'm limited into who I know, but if I take your advice, if I do what you're talking about, if I get 30 days to online PR, the success, the marketing success, now all of a sudden I've got that compelling reason for literally millions of people out there. We're not talking about 15, 20, or 100.
And you know, that visibility is more than small businesses could have even dreamed of having before the Internet. Because as a small business owner, before the Internet, you could take out an ad in your local newspaper. You might run an ad on your local radio station. But, you know, unless you lived in a big city, you're not going to reach a very large audience and certainly not people far away from your home base. Only the big corporations could reach millions of people. Now, you can reach millions of people worldwide. You can target who you reach so that people with very specific interests are the only ones getting your communication. And by and large, it's free. You know, that is a revolutionary approach to business.
Oh, no question about it. Gail, we are starting to run out of time. I could talk to you about this all night. But is there a website we can find you at and get the book?
Sure. You can find me online at dreamspinnercommunications.com, and the book, 30 Days to Social Media Success, is in bookstores everywhere, as well as FedEx Office stores nationwide and Office Max.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all, oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a loving burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all, oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. We'll be right back.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Donald Ford with us earned a bachelor's of science, master's of science, and a doctorate degree in mathematics and psychology from Kansas State and Penn State University. He spent his first 10 years of his career creating a new kind of psychological and developmental services program at Penn State for students and their families. Then Penn State asked him to create a new kind of college, and they called it Health and Human Development. And it stimulated other universities to develop a similar college. And after 10 years as dean, he resigned and returned to the first love, teaching, scholarly and professional work. He published 7 books about psychotherapy and human development. He is the author of Carol's Alzheimer's Journey, Treat Them Like a Person, Not a Patient. Donald, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, there's a tremendous amount of Alzheimer's and mentally debilitating diseases out there and problems. And I really believe in my heart of hearts from all of the interviews I've done over the years that the key is, it's just like your tagline. You treat them like a person, not like a patient. There is the difference between the two, and that could be that missing link to touch that person that is slowly losing who they are.
Well, that's why I wrote the book at the suggestion of my wife, and you're correct, the field is hungry for how to proceed to improve the quality of life for people who are in long-term care. Both my wife and I witnessed the unhappiness and loneliness and misery of Carol's mother, Winifred, when she suffered and died in a nursing home of Alzheimer's disease when Carol was about 50 years old. And a few years later, the same thing happened to Winifred's sister, so Carol was concerned that she, too, might end up with Alzheimer's disease. By that time, I had 30 years of professional experience as a counselor and psychotherapist and a scholar about human development, and I reassured her it doesn't have to be that way. Just because that's the way it's been, there are much better understanding now of what human beings are like.
Is that the difference between the traditional medical model of elder care that we have today and your developmental model? Is that the key?
Well, that's part of the key, but it's also part of social tradition. The medical model's primary purpose, methods, and priorities are focused on what's wrong with a biological person and how to fix it, or at least to keep it from getting worse. The primary control of what's to be done, when and how, is in the hands of professional staff. Caregiver goals take a priority over patient goals because they're responsible for patient care in a medical sense and therefore must often restrict the patient's inborn self-directing processes. The developmental model starts from the assumption about Alzheimer's that you can't fix it. So the medical model really doesn't have anything to do except keep a person alive. The developmental model's primary purpose is to go the opposite direction and say that the focus should be on the capabilities the person still has and how to use those capabilities to pursue goals and activities that bring the person some satisfaction and pleasure that can be facilitated by the staff helping them. So the whole focus shifts from a negative focus of what's wrong to a positive focus of how can we make life better for them.
Another area of consideration, this comes right out of your press release, it's modifications. And this is a challenge that you would face as opposed to what's going on the existing model. Modifications of relevant existing laws, policies, funding, regulatory arrangements, they're essential to support the implementation of an alternative to the medical model for long-term care. You've got laws, you've got rules and regs that you have to come up against to actually implement what you're talking about.
That's true, but you can't make a case for significant change if you don't have a sound knowledge base and and method that you can demonstrate will truly make a difference. Right now, there are a lot of people all across this country struggling to try to produce what they call a person-centered care program. They don't even have a theoretical model of what a person is. Our governor in Pennsylvania has a commission at work to make recommendations about how to deal with the Alzheimer's epidemic that's upon us. And he's got professionals from that field all over, but they're having a struggle trying to find out what kind of a case they can make that would bring more money. The difference with this proposal that I created for my wife is that there is a solid scientific and theoretical base for it, and it can be justified and demonstrated to be effective.
But, Donald, more importantly, it was hands-on. I mean, you had the experience with all of your professional background and then in your personal life with your wife with it, that developmental model, you had to live it every day. This isn't something that just came out of a book.
Would it be useful for me to give your listeners some examples of how it works?
Love it, yeah. Yes.
Yes?
Absolutely, yes.
Oh, okay. I'm 87 years old. I have a little trouble with my hearing. Okay. What's a person? Everyone agrees that we're physical entities, but they also agree that's only part of what we are. We've got goals and personalities and beliefs, and to be adaptively effective, we have to put all of those different parts of us together. And person-level processes operate to ensure that all parts of us as an individual function cooperatively to produce what we want. Every person is born with five evolution-based processes that operate as a team, enabling a person to adaptively create and guide their activities. Self-direction, self-organization, self-regulation, self-achievement, self-reward. We aren't machines. We are self-constructing entities. And so when you take that concept and apply it to trying to help people in long-term elder care who have serious limitations, you have to have some framework for getting through those limitations to help them make a life. And that's what this framework does by providing a sound knowledge base about the nature of memory problems and how to work with those memory problems to accomplish helping individuals with those limitations to have a better life.
Okay, Donald,
sure.
You're also talking. Well, let me hold you up for a minute, because what I'm hearing you, and stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not a clinician, but what I'm hearing is you've created a language, let's call it the missing link, to communicate to those things that we have let go because we haven't found a resource or a source to touch them.
Well, let me give you one example as an example of how this works. You start by finding out what a person's history of activities have been during their lives that gave them pleasure. The first part of this book does that for Carol because that's needed to know how to use it to help them with their illness. So that's why the book is written in two parts. The first part is tells about her development, and the second part uses that knowledge to build a care program. Now, as an example, when Carol's illness progressed, neural patterns needed to reactivate and help perform various forms of walking activity were increasingly disrupted by the neural deficiencies, and that made it difficult for her traditional memory cues to activate behavior episode schemas for walking. But what you do is when that happens, you find other patterns of memory cues to take a different pathway through the brain to activate activity in them that you want. And so with Carol, she had a muscle removed years ago and had to walk with a cane, so we helped her do that. Then when that didn't work, we helped her walk. And then when that didn't work, I said, I wonder what mobility pattern she has of any kind that we could use to help her move around. And I focused on her long history of competence and pleasure in social dancing. We first danced when she was 16. We loved it. And throughout our lives, we danced whenever we could to different forms of music and different forms of dancing. So we constructed a elaborate behavior episode schema for dancing. When she couldn't walk in any way, I decided to try activating that pattern that she had a long history with. So I put on a Glenn Miller recording of String of Pearls, took her into a dancing embrace, and off we went without stopping. We went through the dining room, past her piano, through the living room, and our entry garden. The garden, Carol had to take a small step up. She tried to lift her right leg up, but she couldn't move it. She couldn't figure out how to do it. So after a while, she tried the left leg, and it worked, and she made the step, and we finished our dance. She grinned with great pleasure, and if you think about the solving problem that went on in her head when her right leg didn't move, you have to take it seriously that these people have a lot more going on in their head than we give them credit for. We just don't know how
to... Donald, we're talking about, let me see if we can paraphrase this. We're talking about recognition. You've got those mirror neurons in the emotional part of your brain. They fire up when they recognize something external that you've been through. So now something's happened where they're not connecting. But if you dance with her, you create an additional recognition. The recognition triggers the brain chemistry to cause the memory to respond. Am I close here?
Well, you're getting closer.
Okay.
The problem is that memories are, when permanent memories are formed, they last forever. The problem is you have to reactivate them. You have to reconstruct them. Memory isn't like looking at a picture. Memory is reconstructing the original experience. Memory is a constructive process. And so to get that to happen, you have to have something going on in the present episode that functions as a memory cue for activating what you want to come back. And there are different pathways of memory cues that you can use. When one doesn't work, you can use another. It isn't that the memories aren't still there. The problem is you have to find the pathway into them.
Okay, so in essence, what you're really dealing with is then changing the chemical response, finding another pathway back to, it's a language, it's a communication, it's a brain communication. And that in and of itself can cause the end result that you're looking for.
Well, it isn't necessarily a chemical reaction. There are two things that have happened in our society that we're just now beginning to understand in terms of behavior. One of them is the biology of how the body works. The other one is we've discovered that a powerful influence in life is information, the kind of thing, the business you're in now. It isn't the chemical characteristics of the neurons that produce memories and guide behavior. It is the patterns of activity created in those neurons that carry the information, as does a program in a computer. And so you're not necessarily influencing or affecting the chemistry of the neuron. You're influencing or affecting the patterns by which those neurons are interacting with one another.
Okay, so all right. So effectively, you're not changing the chemical. You're changing the pathway of the chemical for the recognition.
And you do that with information.
Yeah.
What goes in through the eyes, the ears, and the skin, and all the rest of that carries patterns of information that enable us to deal with the world around us and with ourselves.
You know,
that's what you're trying to do right now, and that's what I'm trying to do right now on the radio.
Sure. And, Donald, why aren't we teaching this in school? Why doesn't this start in the junior high schools, you know, and move through? What a difference in the world that we would have with our mental health, with our physical health, emotional health. There would be such a difference if this was actually taught in the schools.
Well, I'm not quite sure what you want to be taught.
exactly what you're talking about, that the recognition, the changing of the patterns, and so on and so forth. And we get to realize that there's so many things that we do that are completely unconscious. We're not even aware of why we do what we do. And if we get a handle of the mechanics, the dynamic of it, then all of a sudden you have choice and options that you didn't have before. You're not just responding and reacting.
Well, one of the things that it's difficult for those of us who work in trying to help other people deal with their lives is that we tend to think that we can do things to them that will make them different. We are all self-constructing. And so if I try to teach a student something and it doesn't fit what they want to do or what they currently believe, their personal self-directed motivation will ignore what I'm trying to give them. So you're talking about trying to change a whole strategy of what goes on when people are learning. Education
Absolutely.
Right now is working very hard at trying to create new patterns as this new knowledge about how human development works comes along. But I'm not in that business. I'm in the business of trying to do something for long-term elderly
sure.
care when they've got things like Alzheimer's that make their limitations such that it's very difficult for them to learn new things. But if we can use the old things they've already learned to help them have a better life, that can be done now.
Oh, absolutely. Makes sense. Donald, we're starting to run out of time now. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at to get the book?
Yes, there's a website. The access is carolsjourney.com. And the book's available in both ebook and print volumes in all kinds of Amazon and all kinds of bookstores and so on.
Wonderful. Hey, Donald, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss the night hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Hey, baby, if you really want me in wrong, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. I'm the one I need, yeah. It's some of these days I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Beverly Goldman with us. She's a writer, a raconteur, a wordsmither, song creator, a soul hippie. a peacenik and a self-professional guinea pig, and who loves testing unconventional ways to shift paradigms in the playing of fields of healthcare, storytelling, and, of course, world peace. With the heart of a compassionist, she views the world as a full glass of optimism, courageously uncovers the humor in life's crazy situations. She's the author of Confessions of a Middle-Aged Hippie, Observations of Life on Earth, and Other Cosmic Meanderings. Beverly, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. That sounded like quite a mouthful.
I was trying to get through it. Thank goodness it wasn't in the beginning of the show. I would have never made it. No,
there you
go.
You did excellent. So thank you very much for that lovely introduction.
Now, by the way, when it really comes down to it, being a middle-aged hippie, the world has changed completely, and yet at the same time, if you have that peacenik, that stuff, whatever that is in you, it stays, doesn't it? And it moves out into every area of your life.
Well, you know, I absolutely agree with you. If you really look at what's happening now, I think the nostalgia from that period is so evident. I mean, the other night, I don't know if you've seen it yet, Marilyn Monroe happens to be the new spokesperson for Chanel No. 5. And, I mean, last week, you know, with the 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's assassination, it was just a really, really poignant time, and it was very powerful, and it seems to me that this crosses all age barriers. So the interesting part for me is that people hear the word hippie and they may think that, you know, relates to a lifestyle, a particular lifestyle that was portrayed in the media. I have quite a different definition of hippie, and it does have to do with the value systems that were birthed back then, and I agree with you, they're very much alive now and part of our conversation every day.
No, absolutely. It may look differently, but it's that same underlying that methodology of how to deal with life and what the world should be like. There are areas of it I completely agree with. There are areas of it I'll contradict. But at the same time, you got to respect something that's there and that has stayed for all of these years.
Well, and the interesting thing is, you know, I come in contact with a lot of people of, you know, a lot of different ages. And when I say to them certain things like hippies stood for peace, music, and art, meditation was born back then. Community was so huge. These are all concepts that are so part of our everyday life now. I have kids in their 20s going, wow, I guess I'm actually a hippie then.
Yeah,
and, you know, this is where I agree with you that the definition that's been out there to do with lifestyle, sex, drugs, rock and roll, et cetera, is part of it, but it's really this value system that's so alive now. And part of our conversation, because this is what we need, I think, in our world now, you know, who wouldn't want world peace right now? This would be so idyllic, but wouldn't it be amazing if we were moving towards that somehow?
By the way, I would absolutely love that. Anybody who didn't want that would have to be insane, because you're not only talking about yourself, but your families and everything else that happened. But there is a problem with that, and I think that what I've seen over the years, here's where the problem is. I would love to see world peace. There's no question about that. But you can't just give up your armies and your weapons and your everything else, because if you don't have the same mindset from your quote-unquote enemies, you've got a major problem. So there's that wall to cross where there's got to be a commonality of definition where everybody can really finally get together. There are people all over this world that are taught that, you know, we're these horrible people and somebody else is horrible. But I really believe if you go from country to country and you got with the people, they're no different than you and I talking right now. It's what happens when it's at that higher level of wanting something and using people to get there.
Well, and I feel there's a change, but this could be the circles that I travel in. Like, I see this more in the research I see being done, that if they taught, you know, if we taught meditation at a public school level within one generation, we would have people who experience inner peace, and, of course, world peace starts with inner peace, right? It's personal. It's something that happens from within, not from without. So there is a movement there. I'm very optimistic. Obviously, I'm a full-glass optimist, right? So I see the possibilities, and it does sometimes seem like how is it possible?
And by the way, I'm an optimist, but I'm more of a pragmatist than an optimist. It's like today. I've never seen such a division in this country in my entire life. You know, blacks hate whites, men hate women, the women hate this, and greens hate yellows and whatever. And there's got to be a stop to it. You've got people pushing these things, And there are people who are getting hurt, and they're innocent people, and they don't have to be hurt. It's mindset, and whatever driving those mindsets, that's what has to happen. And I do believe, truly, when you're talking about meditation, it's that calming effect and that collective consciousness that is created when you do that. And I truly believe once you do something like that, you know, that hurting and harming somebody really goes out of your consciousness. But it's to get somebody, to get both sides to do that. That's where the key is.
Well, and I mean, the movement is definitely towards, I mean, I see this, you know, I'm like Marianne Williamson. I don't know if you know her. She's one of the great thought leaders, like who bridges kind of spirituality and, you know, every day. And she's running for Congress in California, and her platform, she's really gaining momentum. And I do see this around the world with online sites that are, I'd say the everyday man has the ability to have a voice now with, you know, organizations like Aves who are really changing policy in countries where we're seeing things that are happening horribly. And I think this idea of not being complacent and realizing that your voice can make a change in the world when you join with enough other people who have the same ideologies.
I agree, but let's take it to the extreme now. I think you've got Iran and a couple of those countries that they're fighting right now. Women are demonstrating they should have driver's licenses. And women are treated as people. They're treated as, you know, as property. Now, how do you deal with a mindset like that on an equal level? That's where I'm coming from. You've got to be able to have somebody that can change their thinking. But if you look at the way they run the countries, you obviously know control is so ingrained that it's going to be hard to get everybody to sit down and meditate.
Of course, and this is why it's this groundswell movement, right, where you have the people movement, which is where I believe that really happened during the hippie generation. We didn't have internet. I don't know how old you are, but if you remember, it was very much community-based, and it was word of mouth, and this is what I see happening now online. So, it's, you know, it depends where you look. So there's this saying that you will always find evidence to support whatever you believe. And, you know, I've been told a lot of things in my life that were impossible based on science and statistics, and I have said, let me see what's possible in, you know, in relationship to my own personal health.
Sure.
In many areas of my life. And so this is where I think the individual has to take responsibility. And it can start with the children. Why not? The children are the future. Why not start with the young generation? Why not have meditation as part of, you know, a school curriculum?
I want to answer you in a very interesting way for a question you almost asked a moment ago. I was around before there were hippies.
Okay.
Like, no, I saw the whole movement. From the beginning and all the way through, and I got that. And I really believe what you're saying is I would back it up. Not would I do back it up 3,000%, but I still say there's got to be that practicality of that those people on the other side that will harm you. And there is such violence going on in our own country. Well, no, you're in Canada, right?
I am.
Okay, in the United States, there's such violence going on right now that I've never seen it this bad. I don't even know where it's coming from. And yes, if you can get some of these kids to turn around and to do some of the things that you're talking about, I believe that there could be some tremendous changes. You know, we've got about a 55% dropout rate in school here, and it's horrible. And you got a lot of kids.
That's sad. That's very sad. So another thing I really stand for in the world is, like, I know personally the transformative power of art and music. And I can't imagine anyone would disagree. When you're involved with music, like just even listening to music you like, it has a transformative and a healing power. There's a lot of organizations, and this is one of the things I'm involved with here, is groups that are working with children. There's the Children's Peace Theater here, and literally they are instilling this idea of peace. And these are all immigrants who come to Canada. They come from war-torn countries. They don't know anything else. It's really possible at that place in someone's life to instill this possibility of peace. And again, I know I might sound idealistic, and there's people who say to me, you weren't even really a hippie. So that, I mean, that's another interesting point. But, you know, all the stories that I have in my book, they're not necessarily, they're about a value system that we can choose to embrace, and I hear you, and you're right. There's really, it seems like we're in an extreme time right now. And this, I mean, I'm very much into astrology. For people who understand astrology, what was happening back in the 60s in some ways is being mirrored now, but in a very conflicted way. So we're going through some crazy times where institutions like government, the economic system, all the institutions we held so near and dear are in some ways we're seeing these crumbling, right? And there's a lot of fear, I would imagine. When I hear the statistics you're saying, Michael, that's crazy when I hear there's that much more violence, but that's the extreme. That's the extreme happening again before hopefully we come back to a middle place.
Well, it's the lack of stability is where the problem is, and there's where the fear comes in, there's where the confusion comes in. And the other thing we're missing, I think the key is there's no identity here. You know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, there was an identity here. There isn't the family identity here. So, you know, a kid wants to go out and they want an identity, go get into a gang. Go walk down the street and knock somebody out, and you've been approved of by your friends, your peers. So there's where the problem is also. We haven't been able to come up with an identity. And politically here, these guys are crazy, both sides of the aisle at this stage of the game. I think they forgot why they got there in the first place. So when it comes down to it, if you have somebody without an identity and a little bit lost, you're going to find the problems.
Absolutely, and that's why I see some of the groups that I see here, and I would hope you have them in the States as well. I mean, one of the things I hear a lot is they're cutting the budgets for any of the creative arts, so the music budgets, the art budgets, and like for me, these are the things that I actually feel have transformative value for a child, even for an adult. I mean, I know I transformed myself, you know, in an art program when I was deathly, deathly ill and not expected to make it. So there's a lot of other choices out there, and it's like, how do we harness that? You know, how do we have that available to everyone, regardless of socioeconomic group, right? And I'm sure it is much more dramatic in the United States. I mean, we have, you know, the political systems everywhere have their own interesting issues, we'll say.
Sure, sure. There's no question about that. But it's that feeling the ability to be able to lean on somebody. You know, if a mother and a father aren't a mother and a father anymore the way they were years ago. A mother and a father years ago were, you know, they set the family. You wouldn't think of walking into your home and using a four-letter expletive to your mom or dad. Well, they do that today. And there is where the problem is. There's no respect for anything. And if you, when I say you, me, all of us, if we want what you're talking about, it has to come from inside, not outside. And the problem
100%.
Is... 100%. Yeah, they're looking for it outside.
And, of course, any time we look for something outside, this I learned very much in my health journey, was that I was always looking for something out there. What's the new treatment or what's the new this? And what I realized is until the transformation happens within, it can't happen. So, you know, I'm still going to remain optimistic, and I'm hearing you because, you know, like I'm not exposed to that every day because I don't live in the United States. I mean, I live in a big city in Toronto, and we have our own share of interesting things going on with our mayor, et cetera, who's now kind of a worldwide symbol of I'm not sure what. You know, but we don't have that extreme, or I don't see that extreme. So that's, you know, I really respect that part of, you know, what you're seeing in the United States right now.
No, see, that's what you got to do. You got to get a bunch of people together with signs to get the mayor to meditate.
I don't, you know, it's so interesting that,
so.
Yeah, his approval rating is still very high.
Absolutely. He's become an entertainer.
Yeah, it's like, who does he represent?
Like,
you know, and that's the big question. Who does he represent?
But the key is now they know who he is. People know who he is that didn't know who he was before. Look at Miley Cyrus before she was doing the crazy things she was doing in the last month or so. You knew who she was, but she wasn't always in front. You know her. You wouldn't think of her name. So that back to the identification thing. I think there's where the major problem is, has been, and always will be, until we get some kind of a commonality of something that says it's okay to be you, and we love you for who you are, and it's you know, go live.
Absolutely, I totally accept you. Like, you know, accept you for who you are. And that, people just want to be seen and heard. That's really, it's that simple.
Down to it, yeah, absolutely. And if I don't love me, how can I love you? And there's where the key is. If you don't have it internally, you can't give it to someone else.
Yeah, and sometimes for some people it's easier, and for other people it becomes like kind of a life journey, you know, getting to that place. But I certainly think it's more available, and I think it's more out there. You know, I think it's more out there to hear, to listen to. You know, I think of some of the people that are like someone like a Deepak Chopra and then an Oprah, and they're doing these meditation series that are free online. So there's available resources. It's a matter of choice. So this is where it comes to individual responsibility to make a choice.
Sure, and the example is very simple of changing and doing whatever and getting everything done. It's like the guy who walks into the doctor's office, picks his arm up like he's going to make a bicep muscle, and he says to the doctor, it hurts when I do this. And the doctor said, well, don't do that.
That's it. And in every moment we have that choice. Don't do that. Do something else. Make another
Absolutely.
Choice.
Absolutely. Yeah, if it hurts, don't do it. Okay. Beverly, we're just about out of time. Yeah, do you have a website we can find you at?
I have a website. It's beverlygolden.com, and my first name is spelled with an L-E-Y, so it's Beverly. You'll find me even if you spell it wrong. And, of course, the book, Confessions of a Middle-Aged Hippie, and places to buy it there online, and a little bit more about the book. And really what I am is a storyteller. And what I hope is that through my stories, people see either a little bit of themselves, take something away, and, of course, it's individual. Everybody will take something much different away. And I've done it in a conversation, just like you and I are having, and that's what people are really enjoying. It's a conversation, my book. It's an ongoing conversation. So.
No, I hear you loud and clear. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us.
I really appreciate the offer. Thanks so much. It was a lively conversation we had here.
Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye for now.
If I were a carpenter and you were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby? If a tinker were my trade, would you still find me carrying the pots I made, following behind me? Save my love through loneliness, save my love through sorrow. I've given you my onlyness, give me your tomorrow. If I worked my hands in wood, would you still love me? Answer me, babe, yes I would. I'd put you above me. If I were a miller, yeah, at a mill wheel grinding, would you miss your colorblind? Little girl, your soft shoes shining. If I were a carpenter and you were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby?
Hello?
Well, welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Alan with us, and we are going to talk about HMOs now they're perpetuating a health crisis in the elderly. Alan's a retired neuroimmunologist. He's published the weekly. He's published weekly in the fields of medicine and medical research. He is best known for his discovery of a new class of drugs for treating HIV and AIDS and his work on chronic fatigue syndrome. He's developed an interest in geriatric medicine, and he said when he becomes elderly himself, let's say, Alan, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we really come down to it, the way the world is going right now, I think the elderly are going to have a little bit of a problem. I'm going to go back to the movie years ago, Soylent Green. When you turned a certain age, they made food out of you and spread it out for everybody to eat.
I don't know if you ever saw the Star Trek episode where there's a civilization that expects people to commit suicide when they're 65 because they use up too many resources. I think that's where we are.
Yeah, By the way, I'm almost at that point, too. We're cutting back here, we're cutting back there. They're going to cut back on, you know, Medicare and et cetera. What's going to happen when somebody is, you know, 65-plus and they don't have the ability to bring in any money anymore?
Well, what we need is we need somebody to advocate for elderly people. That's the problem.
Oh, no, I totally agree. But those who advocate have got to have the right message, a message that will resonate with the majority of people out there, because there's so many people out there being advocates, and most people have no idea what they're saying.
That's generally true in America, isn't it? But what elderly people need to do about this real problem of the seriousness of anemia in this population and the way it's ignored is they need to do what AIDS patients did. They need to find out about the disease so they can speak about it and they know when people are telling them the truth and when they're not. And then they need to take a collective action to force the HMOs to stop ignoring them.
Okay, let's start from scratch, because we and I found this for years and years and years doing interviews, Alan, that we say HMOs and things like that, and we have this because we deal with it on a daily basis, that we assume that everybody knows what we're talking about there out there, and what I found is they don't. So let's start from scratch. An HMO is a what?
It's a health maintenance organization. And there's basically two types. One type, like Kaiser Permanente, which may be the only facility in this category, operates their own hospitals, has their own doctors, and you don't get to see anybody except their doctors in their hospital. Then the other model is that the HMO has a network of providers, but they pretty much, you know, decide what providers you can see and what those providers can do.
Now, by the way, with the Obamacare now, how much of an effect is that going to have on the elderly?
It's going to have a terrible effect. The worst thing you can do to an elderly person is prevent him or her from seeing the doctor who's gotten to know them over the years. I mean, that's never a good idea, but in elderly people, it's catastrophic. And that's exactly what we see Obamacare doing, isn't it?
Yeah, no, by the way, I completely agree with what you just said, but by the way, we see it, we experience it, you know it's there, and if you open your mouth, there's some kind of a something that will keep you quiet. If you say something about it, you're either going to get the IRS will step come to your front door and they'll check you out, or you're a racist, or you're this, or you're that. See, that's one of the problems that we have, the challenges to overcome to be able to change things. They take a sideswipe at you.
Well, yeah, I know. It's been very partisan and everything is politicized, but, you know, Mother Nature doesn't care about that. And if somebody is really at risk because of a medical condition and has a terrible quality of life because of a medical condition, we can't pass any man-made laws to make that go away. We have to use science. We have to use clinical medicine. And there's no point in politicizing it.
No, I completely agree. I don't know where we've gotten to, but whatever it is, you know, we've gotten there. And there's got to be some kind of a reversal on it. You know, you watch television every day and you listen to both sides of the aisle. And by the way, neither one of them really have a good way to go or any kind of an alternative. It's going to take somebody with the strength of conviction to move through and get things changed. Right now, people are frightened to death of moving because if I say something, I'm not going to get something from the government. Government has a tremendous control over the basic population now. And look at the amount of people on welfare as opposed to where it was 4 or 5 years ago. It's changing. We're becoming so dependent, we let them do anything they want because we're not going to get the check at the end of the month.
Well, not only are we not going to get the check, but, you know, the way the government, any government, takes away freedom is with fear. If they can make you afraid of something, then they can say, we're going to take away your right to speak or assemble or whatever because it's dangerous and we're protecting you from whatever. So it's we've got to get past this fear that both parties have created.
Sure. Now, but what are some of the steps to do it? And by the way, it's going to take some big steps to move through this. But how do we start? What's the beginning first step to take?
Well, I think the first step, again, for elderly people who have, especially bad in today's environment, is to become informed about whatever ails them and then to be aggressive in fighting for what they need and in trying to do it in some kind of concerted way because the individual patient really can't do much. But you get an organization of patients. I mean, imagine if the HMOs weren't treating breast cancer. There would be a riot. But it's okay to not treat anemia in the elderly, even though it's often just as fatal. It's just a lot easier to treat. So it's becoming informed, number one, and number two, taking concerted action.
Well, but that's the whole point, is taking the action. You know, look at where the Tea Party started. Now, I'm not going to get political, but the Tea Party started, and you saw them on television. They're average everyday's mom and dad. They're not monsters. And the next thing we know, they're vicious, they're terrorists, they're this, they're that, they're whatever. So the moment that you take action, you've got to be able to protect yourself against the powers that be that will try to take away what it is that you're trying to communicate.
Oh, sure. I mean, the unstated requirement for taking action is that you have to have some courage and you have to be willing to be attacked because you're going to be. But if you can get past that fear and just, you know, use scientific evidence. Look, here's the evidence. This disease is dangerous and debilitating in the elderly. It's easy to treat. Maybe I'm a monster. What are you if you won't treat this disease?
Okay, and then we throw it back to throwing the old people off the cliff.
Everybody wants to do that. You know why. I mean, the advertisers don't want us because they think we don't buy anything. So what are the demographics everybody's after? 18 to 49, 18 to 29. So we're not consumers. We're certainly not sex objects, either for reproduction
or
pleasure.
Some of us aren't.
Oh, okay. Well, present company always excluded.
Thank you.
In my case, as a, for example, once you get to be 70, you're not much of a sex object. You may be very, very sexually active, but let's face it, you're not going to have the bubble gummer swooning over you, you know?
You graduated high school, what, 1961 then?
1954.
Oh, 54. Oh, okay, my hat's off to you. You got me by 6 years.
You mean I'm 6 years younger?
No.
Six years older.
Yeah, I got out in 1960.
Well, look, I'm older than everybody, so...
Yeah, okay, but wait, my hat is off to the... I'll give you the elder wisdom. Go for it.
Okay, well, the elder wisdom is that we are not useful to society, and like in this fictional alien society that wants people to off themselves at 65, we consume a disproportionate amount of medical services. So what's really efficient is to get rid of us. And maybe that's why they're doing this. Who knows? But certainly the problem Obamacare is going to face is if they have a lot of people like us and not young, healthy people who are willing to spend too much for the health insurance to pay for our needs.
Oh, by the way, I completely agree, because when it comes down to it, this isn't a mindset of a few people. There's an ideology behind what you're talking about, and that's where the battle is.
Well, you've heard the manifesto, from each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. The reason that doesn't work is that the people who have abilities also have needs, so they're not going to give their abilities away. Excuse me, I have a cold on top of everything else.
By the way, that's two of us, so you get older, it happens. Radio Susie's over there laughing. She said, I'll get you a wheelchair to get out of here.
You can borrow mine anytime.
Thanks. But when you really come down to it, that's realistically where it is. Because there are certain things that happen with the elderly. It's a natural chain of events. You know, we get older, we become, quote-unquote, a burden on society, etc., while they're spending money over here, having a good time, and the debt goes up, they've got to cut it someplace. So where do they cut it? They cut it from you and I, they cut it from the military, they cut it from all the places. That's absolutely insane, and I think this place within 5 years or so is going to be an absolute disaster.
Do you think it'll take 5 years?
No, I was being...
I don't think it'll take that long. I think it's going to be a disaster before the end of the president's term.
Yeah, because he doesn't care. And I didn't want to get political, but obviously he's going to get what he wants to get, and that's the end of that one. And you can see it. He's got... He doesn't have another term he's looking forward to, so he's going to get what he wants to get. And that's what you're up against. And that, I say, we are up against. And that is a rough fight to make.
Well, the only saving grace, I think, is that I do think that the president is very loyal to his party. And I think he's not going to want to do anything that would get his party out of power or get a Republican nominated or elected president. So even though he doesn't have another term, I do think he is concerned about the next elections, because I do think he's very loyal to his party.
Now, by the way, Alan, we're starting to run out of time now. Let me ask you this. Do you do blogs? Do you have a website we can find you at?
I don't have a website, but I can give you a better one. What you want is you want the website of the journal that published my paper, which reviews, it's a peer-reviewed, open-access journal, and it reviews all of the studies that have been done over the last decade showing that even mild anemia in the elderly is debilitating and dangerous. And the best way to get to that journal's website is to know the name of the journal, Advances in Aging Research. Aging, by the way, is spelled A-G-I-N-G. If you plug that into Google, near the top, you'll see Advances in Aging Research Scientific Research Publishing, which is the publisher. And you go to that and scroll down, read my paper, become informed on this issue.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you for the work that you're doing, and thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you for the work you're doing. You're really helping get the word out, and it was a pleasure being with you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, Michael. Thanks.
I'm Michael Dresser.
I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friend, is...
a wrap.
Off come the clown disguise. The curtains fall. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door. As they say in this bit, that's all there is. There isn't anymore. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.